So last week we read verse 39. Let's read today verse 40 on page 77 of the Brahma Samhita book. Yasya prabha prabhavato jagadanda koti kotishvashesha vasudhadi vibhuti bhinnam tad brahma nishkalam anantam ashesha bhutam govindam adipurushang tamahang bhajami. Yasya, of whom, prabha, the effulgence, prabhavata, of one who excels in power, jagat anda, of universes, koti kotishu, in millions and millions, ashesha, unlimited, vasudha adi, with planets and other manifestations, vibhuti, with opulences, pinnam, becoming variegated, tat, that, Brahma, Brahman, Nishkalam, without parts, Anantam, unlimited, Ashesha Bhutam, being complete, Govindam, Govinda, Adi Purusham, the original person, Tam, him, Aham, I, Bhajami, worship. Translation, I worship Govinda, the primeval Lord, whose effulgence is the source of the non-differentiated Brahman mentioned in the Upanishads. Being differentiated from the infinity of glories of the mundane universe appears as the indivisible, infinite, limitless truth. Purport, the mundane universe created by Maya is one of the infinite external manifestations of accommodating space, time, and gross things. The impersonal aspect of Godhead, the non-differentiated Brahman, is far above this principle of mundane creation. But even the non-differentiated Brahman is only the external effulgence emanating from the boundary wall of the transcendental realm of Vaikuntha, displaying the tri-quadrantal glory of Govinda. The non-differentiated Brahman is indivisible, hence is also one without a second, and is the infinite and residual entity. Govindam Adipurushang Tamaham Bhajami. Haribo. Welcome. So, here, this is a wonderful verse and purport. It sort of sums up in a nutshell a lot about the Vaishnava philosophy. If one studies the Upanishads, they're, in a sense, the beginning, although they're the end of the Vedanta, they're the end of the Vedic knowledge, but the Vedic knowledge deals with a lot of about... three modes of material nature, fruitive activities, how to achieve different things within the world of time and space. But the end of knowledge talks about, well, this world of time and space is limited and it's actually illusory. Things don't last here. Everything has a creation, a destruction. There's something beyond that. And we belong, what our real identity is, belongs to that which is not temporary. Like Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, na sato vidyate bhavam, na bhavo vidyate sataha, ubhayor api drishto antastvanayos tatvadarshivihi. So, those who are wise, who study the nature of things, understand that if that which is real, there is no cessation. And if that which is not real, there is no endurance. So, the Upanishads distinguish between the mundane world, which is temporary, full of ignorance, situated in time and space, gross things which are always becoming decayed and degraded, and that which actually exists beyond that, the shining prabha, the effulgence of spirit, which is self-illuminated, never decays, It is not temporary, it's not created or destroyed, it's fully conscious, and it's beyond the darkness of the material realm, and it's beyond time and space. It has no inside and outside, it can't be divided, it can't be, it doesn't have different parts, it's one without a second, there's nothing greater than it, and so forth. So it's describing these things, in a beginning way. It's the beginning stage of realizing the Absolute Truth. The Absolute Truth is realized in three features, right? Vedanti tat tatva vidas tatvam yajjnanam advayam brahmeti paramatmeti bhagavaniti shabdaya. It's all non-dual, and so these are all parts of the Absolute Truth. But here it's saying, this shining Brahmajyoti effulgence is what? It belongs to someone, a person, right? Yasya, yasya prabha. It's his, that is Govinda's shining effulgence. It comes from Govinda. Now, it defies logic to us because when we think of if there can't be duality, in a world where there wouldn't be duality, how could there be a person and that which he possesses? Or a person and that which he emanates, you know, two different things. But in the nature of absolute truth, this is possible. That there can be a person and also that which emanates from him, and although those two things can be distinguished, yet at the same time there's no duality, there's no separation, there's no difference. They're non-different. They're part of one absolute truth whole. So this concept is difficult for people to understand. So a lot of the beginners in spiritual life, they think, oh yes, I understand spirit is something that's beyond time and space. It has no form. It's beyond any material form. It's beyond material personality. All the relationships we have in the material world are painful, but they're based on the illusion of people identifying themselves as the body. But there really is an identity beyond the body, and that is spirit, and it's eternal, and it has none of these different mundane characteristics. but then when they hear about the pastimes of the Absolute Truth as a person, a Bhagavan, Supreme Person, they say, no, that doesn't make sense, because that's 'cause then he would be like an ordinary material, like a mundane person. But he's not like a mundane person. But he's actually... The thing is that to have personality, to have intention, to have will, to have senses, to have cognizance, to have all these things is greater than to have none of these things. So the form of the Absolute Truth in which, as Govinda, in which he has all these things and he has an expansion of his energy, that's actually more complete and more a more full understanding of Absolute Truth than just understanding the white light of the Brahmajyoti. It's more complete. But due to our poor fund of knowledge, Srila Prabhupada would say, due to our conception of what things are possible and what things are impossible, we sometimes resist hearing that, well, there can be such a person who is actually the source of the impersonal Brahman, and that everything is resting on his personal energies, and yet he's not different from those energies. It's hard to conceive of until one actually, because we can't use our mundane logical and our mundane experience to understand it. We have to hear it from a transcendental source and understand it in that way through service and submission, and then that knowledge can be imparted to us. Otherwise, we can't through empirical philosophical speculation and comparing things to this world. We can never understand how Govinda is really more infinite than the infinite, impersonal, all-pervading, unmanifested Absolute Truth. He's not different from the Absolute Truth. He is the Absolute Truth in his personal feature. And yet the impersonal Absolute Truth is an emanation, is described as an emanation from him and of his, belonging to him, his halo, his Brahmajyoti. So this has, being differentiated from the infinity of glories of the mundane universe. So it's being, actually even the mundane universe is an expansion of his energies and is non-different from him, but we are experiencing it as mundane because we are ignoring him. We're forgetting him. We're forgetting his relationship with it. And therefore it's differentiated from him. It's his separated energy. The material energies are called his separated material energies. The the Greek pre-Socratic philosopher Parmenides, he wrote a poem, a kind of an ode, a spiritual ode, a philosophical ode, describing the world of appearances we see as being made up of two things, that which is and that which is not. He was a goddess appeared to him and revealed to him that there were two things, that which is and that which is not. And that which is indivisible. It's the way he described it is perfectly round. That is, it doesn't have any end, and it can't be cut into parts. It can't be divided. There's nothing other than it, and that's the only thing that exists. So then, his disciple was Zeno, and you've probably heard of Zeno's paradoxes, right? So Zeno's paradoxes were things like, you know, if you take a brick, it can't have any shape. Because why? Because it has to be... Of course, they didn't have calculus in those days. See, it has to be either made up of unlimited small part. You can keep dividing it into small particles. And you can either divide it into a certain number of particles of a certain size, or... this is just one of them. I mean, maybe one of them was like the race Achilles can never catch the tortoise. If you give a tortoise a head start, and they're racing, then before the fast runner Achilles can catch the tortoise, he has to cover half the distance to the starting line, and by that time the tortoise has already gone some distance. Then from there he still has to cover the next half a distance. And the tortoise still goes a little further. And then from there, he covers the next half a distance. The brick, I don't remember that one, but, you know, it's like, if a thing has a certain number, it either has to be made up of a number of small parts. It could be, if you can divide it, then you can keep dividing and dividing and dividing. Then either if you can divide them to infinitely small parts... He had a paradox where you have to get to a size of a part that either can't be divided anymore or can be divided anymore. And if it can be divided anymore, then there has to be an unlimited number of them. And if it can't be, then it has to, some. I don't remember, but somehow. Take the microphone.
The logic here is that if the division process doesn't end at one point. Then it continues and continues. But if it continues and continues, then the brick size is limited, right?
Uh-huh.
So going, there's a paradox there. So that means that it can be divided to the point at which... I mean, finally we reach a point at which it can't be divided anymore.
Uh-huh.
Because, again, I repeat the logic here is that... Because if we don't reach a point where we can't find an indivisible point, then it is like an infinity.
But the brick okay, I just remember. There's another part of the argument, though. He said that... If you can keep dividing into smaller and smaller parts, then you have to go down to an infinitesimally small part, you know. And that small part, no matter how many of those you add together, it still won't have any size. If they're that small, then no matter how many of them they add together, they won't have any size. But if they do have some size, then he would say. He also said that it would have to be unlimitedly big. I don't remember exactly how he said it, but he had an argument like that, that it could... Anyway, he had all these arguments that showed that the world as we understand it, by just our ordinary sense perception, the world that we live in, is really unintelligible, ultimately. That you can also prove that it's really unintelligible, that it's something about time and space. Microphone.
One argument that opposes this is like he's considering only the dimension because there may be many other dimensions, maybe space dimension, time dimension. Maybe by process of, because it takes time to divide it, uh-huh. During that time something may happen. So,
uh-huh.
So he's not considering the dimension of time.
Yeah, there is something inconceivable going on in the world anyway. We can see that. Whether you buy Zeno or Zeno's paradoxes or not, there, the way things happen and the way things are all put together, there's something inconceivable in it. But he made all these arguments that to try to show, because his spiritual master had said that the truth is really indivisible. It can't be divided. And he made points to show that if you can really divide something, the world, in other words, the world that we see is illusory. It's made up of a combination, which then the atomists describe that the atoms in Greek, a lot of the Ionian, you know, Greek physicists, old philosophers, you know, Epicurus, Democritus, I don't remember all of them, but a lot of them, they had this concept of the atom, which maybe you know, you were educated in Russia, right? So they probably studied this Byzantine Empire and you know, the Greek is more. But the idea would be that each little atom is really one one Brahmajyoti kind of, you know, and then they're all put together. And anyway, I don't want to, huh? Paramanu, it's really, I think it may be related. You use the microphone. You know, the concept of Paramanu is here in the Brahma Samhita, and it's also in the Srimad Bhagavatam. There's a, you know, Kapila Dev is describing how there's an Anu, and the concept, the smallest amount of time is actually the amount of time it takes for a beam of light to cross one of these indivisible atoms. So that concept is there in the Bhagavatam and here in the Brahma Sutta. Yeah, what's the verse that says Paramanu? What is it? So when the Bhagavatam talks about atoms and there being, you know, and there's a whole description of the atom and things like that, we shouldn't understand it necessarily to be the same as the atoms theorized about in the modern field of chemistry. They're not exactly the same atoms. They may be some other kinds of particle. But the idea is that the world of form and representation and temporary manifestation is somehow it's not the absolute truth. It's always changing, and therefore there's something unintelligible about it, something that's not really the ultimate pure truth. And but the world that is, that once we understand that the truth is conscious and doesn't depend on time and space and these other things, that doesn't mean that it's impersonal. To be impersonal would be to be less than, to be like a stone would be less than to be like even an animal, a dog or something like that. So to be a person, to be creative, to have potency, to be able to accomplish things, to be able to see things, to care about things, to have relationships even, all these things are qualities which a foolish philosopher would deny those qualities to the infinite absolute truth and admit them in the illusory temporary personalities. But a more astute philosopher would understand that where did they come from? In us. If we have them, they had to come from somewhere. That which comes from this principle is that you know, the effect contains the qualities of the cause. You can't create an effect that wasn't present, at least in some potential form, in the cause. And therefore, we can't have personality if the origin of everything, janmadyasya yataha, the absolute truth, Brahman, is this origin of everything, from which everything emanates, that which in everything exists, and that which into which everything enters. So this Vaishnava philosophy explains that it can't be that the absolute truth being infinite has no personality. That's not a seriously, that's not an acceptable proposition. It has personality, but not the kind of personality that we're accustomed to. We're accustomed to limited personalities, and the absolute truth is an unlimited personality. So it's not that he has no name. Right, we have a name, but he has no name because a name limits us. It's not that; it's that he has unlimited names, and he has so many names. Which, go ahead, and then that, I thought that was a good segue into the Namashtakam, but.
Can you please elaborate on different stages of realization? Like, first we need to realize Brahman and Paramatma and Bhagavan. So what it means to realize Brahman, and then does it mean that the monist school or the impersonalist are in one stage of realization, and then the visist Advaita is proceeding to the next stage of realization, or what it exactly means, realizing the Paramatma? And
the way Srila Prabhupada sometimes explained it is that as an analogy, you may be approaching from a distance, you may be approaching a city in a mountain, on a mountain, and then you first see there's a shape like a shadow of a mountain on the horizon, and then as you get closer, you actually see, oh, there's the mountain, it has trees and it has buildings on it and things like that. And then when you actually enter into the city, then you get to meet the people there and there are animals and there's so many things going on there. So, first stage is realizing, and then all these stages of realization are realized by transcendentalists, those who stop becoming. Most people in any society, most people are just interested in satisfying their belly, making money so they can enjoy material life, and their temporary relationships, avoiding pain and trying to get temporary pleasures. And the wise people, Krishna says, they don't take part in these temporary pleasures, knowing them to be sources of misery. They become inward. They understand there's inner happiness, and they become transcendentalists. And then in the category of transcendentalists, those who first get the first inkling that there's something real beyond the temporary manifestation of temporary forms and personalities of this world, they realize the absolute truth in his feature as the Brahma Jyoti, as the expanse of his all-pervading spiritual power, that it's non-dual, and it's eternal, it's beyond time, and it's beyond space. That is, it's all-pervading. It doesn't have any inside or outside. Can't be put in one place or any. So that's the beginning realization. Then the yogis who control the senses and meditate on the Paramatma, they can understand the feature of the Absolute Truth by which he also is in everyone's heart, localized. He controls everything. Like, we can start to see that each individual person is a person with a consciousness and is part of the Supreme Person, the Supreme Consciousness. We're aware of what's going on in our body, but the Supreme Consciousness, he's aware of what's going on in everyone's body. So that feature, that additional feature of not just existence, eternal existence beyond time and space, but the feature of knowledge is realized in his localized portion as a person who actually is aware of everything that's going on in the pleasures and pains of every living creature. And then feature of Bhagavan, then the devotees, the bhaktas, they enter into an actual personal relationship. So they get to know, as they get to know the personality of Godhead as a friend, as the master, as their child, or in all different personal relationships, they get to know the personality of Godhead and talk to him and do things for him and have him do things back. They have that personal relationship. And in that feature, then, the actual original bliss that's really belongs to our real nature, that we're always hankering after. We're pleasure anandamaya bhyasat. All living beings are by nature pleasure seeking, as is God. And the relationship there between God and the living beings, the loving relationship, is full of pleasure. And when we turn our back on him and we try to find pleasure in relationships with something else, we try to take his position, being the center, rather than being, we talked about last week, we want to be the subject instead of the object of his enjoyment, but actually we're the object of his enjoyment. So when we try to be the subject, then we have to take birth in the material world, we have to As I heard Srila Prabhupada say in Detroit, and he was giving a lecture on the sixth canto, and he said, when we want to stop being the servant of Krishna, so we have to serve something else, basically. So he gives us a false conception of ourself that we can think of. So if we want to be served, we have the false conception of ourselves. So we think, oh, now I can accept service. But unfortunately, that's the illusion. It's not that the energy, the things in this world are unreal. It's not that they don't exist. They exist, they're Krishna's energy. But the illusion is we think that, you know, just like our body actually exists as Krishna's energy, we can use it in service, and it, as such, it becomes purely spiritual if we use it properly in Krishna's service and not for sense gratification. But as soon as we take it to be ourself, and we take ourself to be the enjoyer of sense enjoyment, of the objects of our body, and we take the things around our body to be ours, our possessions, all that stuff is illusory. That's not what we really are. That's not what our bodies really are. It's not what the things in the world are. They can't belong to us. Ishavasyam idang sarvang yat kincha jagatyang jagat. Everything is controlled and owned by the Supreme Person. And the devotees who are, you know, who are fully surrendered to that conception, then only they can have, like, enter into a personal relationship with Krishna, re-enter our eternal personal relationship with Krishna, and experience the bliss that is inherent there. It's like an ocean of bliss. Bhakti Rasamrita, Sindhu. So Sindhu means an ocean. So it's an ocean of nectarian bliss that's there in these personal relationships in bhakti, bhakti yoga. So Krishna and Bhagavad Gita is teaching that we should approach that bhakti yoga. It's not enough to simply meditate on the impersonal Brahman and try to be inactive and think, I'm not this body, I'm just spiritual. In fact, you know, this is what he's urging Arjuna. He's giving this lecture to Arjuna, giving this dialogue to Arjuna, this Upanishad, really, discussion to Arjuna. But he's telling him to do something active, fight the war. You know, and he's saying, first Arjuna says, no, but they'll incur sin, and it will be bad for society, the families will be destroyed, and I have to kill my grandfather, great personalities who have to be respected. And anyway, that what will I get from it? There's no benefit. I wouldn't want to enjoy the kingdom afterwards. And then Krishna says, you're talking like a fool. He says, first you have to understand, you know, everyone is a spirit soul and they're eternal. And you have to understand that spiritual platform. And then Arjuna says, okay, so you tell me it's better to be in fixed in intelligence of understanding that everyone is a spirit soul, then why do you want me to fight? Why can't I just sit down then and be fixed in that knowledge? And then Krishna explains further in the third chapter that that you can't ever stop acting. You have to act properly according to your position. That those who are completely self-realized, they don't have any duties to perform. Otherwise, if you try to pretend to be self-realized, but you're still thinking about the objects of the senses, you're just pretending. You're fake. And he says, and those who don't have any duties to perform, they lead a good example for everyone else. He said, look at me. I don't have any duties to perform in the whole world, right? I created everything. But still, if I didn't behave like a proper religious person, give charity, observe, proper things. I mean, he married so many wives, but in each one, he got married and he provided for her and everything. So he showed the path of Dharma that one has to. This is one can't just willy-nilly you know, like they do nowadays, you know, one girlfriend, one boyfriend, and then they switch, you know, musical chairs or whatever. But they have to get married. It's, you know, and they have to perform the proper Vedic observance. So Krishna said, I follow all the rules, even though I don't have to. If I didn't, everyone would follow me and they would fail. You know, the whole world would be put into ruination. There would be unwanted progeny and everything. So everyone follows what a great person does. So therefore, those who are wise, they can perform the same activities that other people perform, these activities with attachment to the results. But the great devotees, they can perform the same activities. Just like Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he was going every day working as a magistrate and resolving disputes and making judgments about things. You know, a powerful government officer. But at the same time, he was writing in his, you know, in his spare time. He was so active. In his spare time, he was writing so many perfect, ideal spiritual literatures that to enlighten the world about Lord Chaitanya, about the philosophy of bhakti, the Vaishnava philosophy that has been that is the essence of all the Vedic tradition. And it's really the essence of the Upanishads. When I was a new devotee, I always heard all these things about, because Lord Chaitanya said, oh, you know, I don't remember the statement, but he said, you know, the Upanishads are far away, something like that, from the essence of bhakti, you know, dure. I remember the word dure, but I don't remember the exact statement, but that because they mostly deal with, you know, getting the philosophical foundation down very good of understanding how this world is false and that there's something spiritual that's different. But I was always afraid that if I go and I actually examine the Upanishads, they're actually going to support Mayavadi philosophy or something like that. Because all we had was the Ishopanishad. So I was afraid, oh, I can't read these other things because maybe I'll find something that makes me doubt what Srila Prabhupada said. But then when I was in college, I just decided, you know, heck with it, I've got to read these things. And when I read it, I said, oh, it's absolutely, you know, even the translations that were available to me, it was absolutely clear that it's really supporting the Vaishnava philosophy down the line. It's only the twisted commentaries that are trying to force an impersonal comment, you know, an impersonal interpretation on things. Yes, they're not describing Krishna's Leela and things like that. That's true. But the philosophy is correct. It's perfect. And Lord Chaitanya was right. In when he was talking to the Mayavadi philosophers about the Brahma Sutra, Vedanta Sutra and things like that, it's not that we don't touch the Vedanta Sutra. The reason Lord Chaitanya didn't have, or his immediate followers didn't write a commentary on Vedanta Sutra, was because they accepted Srimad Bhagavatam as already the perfect commentary. And then when there was some challenge, then Baladeva Vidyabhusana was actually dictated to him. Govinda dictated to him the commentary, Govinda Bhasha, in a very short time, this perfect commentary. And but the actual text of Vedanta Sutra supports Vaishnava philosophy. And the Mayavad or Vivartavad, you know, interpretation of some of the followers of Shankaracharya have, you know, bent over backwards to deny the personality of the of Godhead, and in doing so, they're actually twisting and giving an interpretation that's untenable. It's not even supported by the actual sutras, by the actual language of the aphorisms. But because it's written in codes, it's hard to understand anyway. It has to be unpacked by commentaries. But the actual commentary is the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is perfect. And now we have the Govinda Bhasha. And there's also Vaishnava commentaries by Madhvacharya and Ramanujacharya. They differ in a little bit from each other, and they're different followers of different sampradayas always debate with each other and say, you know, one is saying we're better, but actually Lord Chaitanya is... yes, go ahead.
What is the difference between Vishishtadvaita and Achintyabhedabheda?
Okay, so Vishishtadvaita is Ramanujacharya's... I am not an expert enough in that philosophy, but he was teaching a Vaishnava philosophy, basically that there has to be he recognized there has to be a distinction between the Supreme Soul and the individual soul. There has to be a meaningful distinction. The basic Kevala Advaita philosophy is just simply monism, and therefore the soul is itself. When the description is given, like if you take a water pot, or you take a pot that contains sky in it, if you break the pot, the sky is part of the whole sky, and there's no distinction. And so we only feel distinct from God because of our illusion. And if we become out of illusion, we'll realize that we are absolutely 100% identical with God. And the Achintya Bheda Bheda Tattva philosophy is, we're identical in some respect. Because it's non-dual. We're his emanations. We're parts of him. So we have the same qualities, like a drop of ocean, a drop of seawater has the same qualities as the ocean. But we're not identical because he could never be covered, and we're covered, so that we can see that we're not controlling, even in our liberated state. We're not controlling all the worlds and everything like that. We're still subordinate in our eternal relationship to Him. Specifically, to get into the details of the Sri Bhashya commentary on Vedanta Sutra and how it differs from Govinda Bhashya, or how it differs from Madhvacharya's Dvaita position. Madhvacharya staked out a very important, to attack the monists, he said, no, there are definitely two distinct tattvas, you know. And you saw the picture of him with his hand, too. Vishishta Dvaita, maybe you can tell more about it, but he's more appreciating that there's duality, yes, but there's also non-duality. You can talk more about it.
What I understood is that I didn't really get the hang of what was the aim of Shankaracharya. Maybe what I understood is that Vishnu wanted to see who are his real devotees. So he sent Shankaracharya to distract people.
Well, at that time also, most of people had become Buddhists.
Yeah.
So Shankaracharya at least...
faith on the Vedas and
he appealed to the mentality of atheism by giving a sort of a Buddhist style, like a covered Buddhist interpretation of the Vedas. Then the atheists also still got their faith in the Vedas.
I could see the slow gradual evolutions, and then when people thought that okay, our aim is to become God, then Ramanujacharya came, no, Vishishta Dvaita. And then Madhvacharya made it more specific, Dvaita. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And then what I understood from Mahaprabhu's principle is that we are similar to Lord, but still we are different. Uh-huh. And that is inconceivable.
Yeah.
And he took principles from different sampradayas. And he took the service attitude. Vishishta Dvaita focuses on the service attitude. We're never equal. And Dvaita is also never equal. But Mahaprabhu's philosophy is...
And the inconceivability, it's not just a cop-out. You know, like Satsarup Maharaj was talking one time about how he had gone to a priest because he was Catholic as a child or something, raised as a Catholic. And... after being in the Navy and reading a lot, becoming attracted, going to college and becoming attracted to philosophy and reading all these different existentialists and things like that, and Nietzsche and, Sartre, So he went to have his confession, which he hadn't done in a long, long time. He went to a priest, and then he told the priest, I don't believe in God. And I don't believe that if God was powerful, he would let the world be so miserable. And I don't, and he argued all these things. And the priest was a young priest, and he was you know, idealistic, and he said, well, you know, you shouldn't come to me like this in confession, but we should come meet me in the, you know, whatever, in the sacristy or wherever, and I don't even know what they call it, you know, and let's talk about all these things. But then he went and he talked to him, but the priest didn't have any answers, and he was just saying, well, it's just a mystery, it's mysterious, God is mysterious, he works mystery. And he felt that, well, that's kind of a cop-out, you know, it's like, it's not an explanation. But the idea of the inconceivability, like Jiva Goswami's Sandarbhas, he very much develops that there are contours of inconceivability. We have to, by examining ourselves, we have to be able to understand that there's, so we cannot conceive of the scope of the sky. You know how big it is. You know it's beyond our capacity. You know, or with the you know categorical imperative. You know we're not equipped as sentient beings to understand certain things. And he explains how there's different kinds of inconceivability and what that really means. So it's not just a cop-out, oh, it's a mystery, we can't explain it, but it's actually a philosophically understood position that says, well, we as limited beings have a certain capacity to appreciate, but we can perceive our direct personal relationship with Krishna, and we can perceive Krishna as a person through the mercy of devotees and devotional service. I had another point there. There's a book called Navadvip Dham Mahatmya, written by Bhaktivinoda Thakur, where he describes, if I remember correctly, Jiva Goswami goes to Mayapur and Lord Nityananda takes him on a tour of all the different holy places. But he reveals that Ramanujacharya, Madhvacharya, Nimbarka Swami, Vishnu Swami, they were all sent by Lord Chaitanya. They were sent earlier to sort of herald his coming and to give a particular piece or an explanation, a part of the puzzle, basically. They were all devotees of Lord Chaitanya, but they were told not to not to talk about Lord Chaitanya coming after. Go ahead.
While writing a commentary on Gita, so Madhvacharya, I was seen in a video, and then Krishna says to Madhvacharya, no, you should not reveal the complete meaning. Instead, you write like this. I've seen that part of the video.
Yeah. And the Shankaracharya also, there's a part in one of the Puranas, I forget which Purana, where Vishnu tells Shiva, or maybe Parvati explains, somehow or another, Vishnu has told Shiva that, you know, in the Kali Yuga you should assume the form of a Brahmin and you should establish the impersonal, it's in the Padma Purana, yeah. So, anyway, let's go to, time is passing and we have to stay on schedule, so let's recite the Nam Ashtakam in the blue tab, in the blue book. Yeah, it's such a wonderful philosophy, this personalist philosophy. It explains everything, you know, it explains devotion. Otherwise, there's no meaning to, you know, the Mayavadis, they say, oh, you're devoted because it helps you become detached and things like that. And then when you realize you're God, you can give it up, you know. But actually, there's nothing better than devotion. You know, there's nothing that should never be given up. It's actually not just the means, but also the goal. Let's start reading. I'll read the Sanskrit, and we'll respond, and you'll respond, and then we'll read the English together. Nikhila Shruti Mauli Ratnamala. Dyuti Nirajita Pada Pankajanta. Ayi mukta kulai rupasya manam paritas twang harinama sangshrayami. Altogether, O Harinama, the tips of the toes of your lotus feet are constantly being worshipped by the glowing radiance emanating from the string of gems known as the Upanishads, the crown jewels of all the Vedas. You are eternally adored by liberated souls like Narada and Shukadeva. O Harinama, I take complete shelter of you. Jayanama Teya Muni Brinda Geya Hey. Janaranjanaya Param Akshara Krite. Twamanadaradapi Managudiritang. Nikhilo Kratapa Patalim Bilumpasi. O Harinama, all glories to you. Sung by all the sages, you are the supreme combination of syllables and you bring transcendental bliss to everyone. If a person utters you but once, even disrespectfully, still you relieve his many extreme sufferings. Yad abhaso pyudyan kavalita bhavadvanta vibhavo. Drishang tatvandhanam apitishati bhakti pranayanim. Janas tasyo datang jagati bhagavan nama tarane. Kriti te nirvaktum ka iha mahimanang prabhavati. O son of the holy name, even a dim glimmer of your splendor swallows the powerful darkness of materialistic life and gives those who are blind to the truth the vision to follow the path of pure devotional service. Who in this world, even if learned and pious, can fully describe your glory? Yad brahma sakshat kriti nishtayapi. Vinasham mayati vinana bhogahi. Apaiti namas puranena tatte. Prarabdha karmeti virauti vedaha. O holy name, the Vedas declare that meditation on the impersonal Brahman cannot bring freedom from karmic reactions, that they must be enjoyed or suffered, but that when you manifest in one's consciousness, all karma at once disappears. Agha damana yashoda nanda nau nanda suno. Kamala nayana gopi chandra vrindabanindraha. Pranata karuna krishna vityaneka swarupe. Twai mamarati ruchaya vardhatang namadheya. O holy name, you have many forms such as Aghadamana, crusher of Akhasura, Yashodanandana, darling child of Yashoda, Yanodanasuno, son of Nanda, Kamalanayana, lotus-eyed one, Gopi Chandra, moon of the gopis, Vrindavana Indra, king of Vrindavana, Pranata Karuna, he who is merciful to the surrendered souls, and Krishna. I pray that my love for you in your many forms may greatly increase. Vachyam vachakam ityudeti bhavato nama swarupa dvayam. Purvasmat param eva hanta karunang tatrapi jani mehe. Yas tasmin vihita paradha nivahak prani samantad bhaved. Asyene damupasya sopihi sadanandam budhau majjati. O holy name, you manifest two forms, the supreme person you designate and the sound vibration that designates. We know that the second form is more merciful than the first, because if a person offends your first form in many ways, you plunge him into an ocean of transcendental bliss if he serves your second form with his voice. Sudita shrita janarti rashaye. Ramya chidgana sukha swarupine. Nama gokula mahotsavayate. Krishna Purna Vapushe Namo Namaha. O holy name, you destroy the many sufferings of those who take shelter of you. You are the very form of concentrated spiritual bliss, a festival of happiness for Gokula, and the perfect and complete form of Lord Krishna. Again and again I bow to you. Narada Vino Jivana. Sudhormi Niryasa Madhuri Pura. Tvam Krishna Nama Kamang. Spurame Rasane Rasena Sada. O enlivener of Narada's Veena, O flood of the waves of sweet nectar, O holy name of Lord Krishna, please forever manifest on my tongue with all your nectarian sweetness. Comments?
O holy name, you manifest two forms, the Supreme Person you designate and the sound vibration that designates. We know that the second form is more merciful than the first, because even if a person offends your first form in many ways, you plunge him into an ocean of transcendental bliss if he serves your second form with his voice. But we also know that there are offenses against the holy name also. That is, even the second form also has, you know, offenses can be committed. So, and then there is a chanting of the names of Nityananda Prabhu and Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu, and there are no offenses to be considered. So going by that, you know, there is a third form which is chanting the names of Nityananda Prabhu and Sri Krishna Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And
it's even more merciful.
Yeah, logically it looks like that. But we don't glorify those names more than the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, usually. And we don't actually, we don't even recommend chanting those names in a way that is, you know, in par or with the Hare Krishna. Because for Hare Krishna, we chant at least, you know, we recommend chant 16 rounds. But we don't say that for the names of Nityananda Prabhu and Sri Krishna Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So if the names of Sri Krishna Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Nityananda Prabhu, even if they are even more merciful than the holy name of Hare Krishna, then why don't we recommend even chanting even one round of those names?
Well, we do recommend people to chant them. When I first learned to chant Hare Krishna, the devotee who showed me to chant Hare Krishna, he also said, you have to learn this mantra. And I was a total newcomer. I was a student in college. I was a young student in college. I became a devotee when I was 17, but I was like already like 15 years old student in college. And I was going to the student union, and there was a devotee chanting under a banyan tree. It was in Florida, so they had a banyan tree, and he had a mridanga, and he was chanting. So I agreed to chant with him. But then he also showed me the Panchatattva mantra, and he said, you have to learn that mantra. If you can chant that mantra, that doesn't accept any offenses, so then you'll be purified, and in ecstasy, then you'll be able to actually chant the Hare Krishna mantra correctly. So it's not that we don't recommend chanting it, but we don't recommend chanting rounds of Nitai Gora, Nitai Gora, or anything like that, because that's not the authorized process that Lord Chaitanya, that's not what Lord Chaitanya wants. But ultimately, that's it, is that Lord Chaitanya came to show us how to enter into the pastimes of Radha and Krishna. And he wants us to learn how to enter into the chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra correctly. And so he's so merciful that we can get great benefit by chanting Nitai Gora. But we shouldn't invent an unauthorized system. Just like there's one group, I forget who they are, one Babaji from 100 years ago or 200 years ago or something like that. He started this Nitai Gora Radhesham. Japa Hare Krishna Hare Ram. Bhaja Nitai Gora Radhesham. Japa Hare Krishna Hare Ram. And if you go like to Haridas Thakur Samadhi in Swargadwar in Jagannath Puri, they have the they keep that place, and you hear them chanting that mantra, which Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati criticized as unauthorized, a concoction. You know, he may have been a nice saintly Babaji or whatever, but he invented something that wasn't approved by the acharyas, and so it shouldn't be followed. So we do chant Nitai Gora, and we also, a lot of devotees, you'll hear it's a commonplace thing. I never read anywhere in Nectar Devotion or something that we have to do it, but most devotees, before each round, they chant one Panchatattva Maha Mantra, or sometimes they chant some other prayers too. You know, after they finish a round, they chant, you know, their obeisances to Prabhupada or whatever, you know. They'll chant Panchatattva Mahamantra. And it says in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Srila Prabhupada explains, because those names don't accept any offense, then devotees can actually taste ecstasy by chanting them. And then they'll be able to chant Hare Krishna more correctly, better.
So that is regarding the chanting. So, but again, regarding the deity worship, also we have Radha and Krishna and Nitha and Gaura. And there somehow, worshipping of Nitha and Gaura, that made it into the mainstream. And there we say, okay, you worship Nitha and Gaura because, Nitha and Gaura, because they don't take the offenses. So that made it to the mainstream, because many devotees have them as the deities as opposed to Radha and Krishna. But as far as the chanting of the names are concerned, still Hare Krishna prevails. So who introduced the worshipping of Nitha and Gaura as an authorized process? Because I'm sure it wasn't existing before.
It was existing at the time of Lord Chaitanya. There are many Nitha Gaura deities. Nitha Gaura, some devotees worship Gaura Gadadhar also. I think Bhaktivinoda Thakur's personal deities were Gaura Gadadhar. But Nitha Gaura, even at the time of Lord Chaitanya, there were many Nitha Gaura temples and Nitha Gaura deities. There was one, was it Sridhar Chaitanya? He had these Gaura Nitha deities, and they looked exactly like actual. If you want to know exactly what Lord Nityananda and Lord Chaitanya looked like, you can go and see those deities, because they're said to be like, very perfect, the facial features and everything, perfect images. And then one time they were having a kirtan there, and Lord Chaitanya and Lord Nityananda were also present, and they were dancing in the kirtan, and the deities were also dancing. And the deities came off the altar to dance in the kirtan, and then there was two sets of Lord Chaitanya and Lord Nityananda dancing in the kirtan. So then Hriday Chaitanya took a stick, and he was trying to get the deities to go back up on the altar and behave like deities. And then they jumped into his heart, and from that time he became known as Hriday Chaitanya. This is in a purport in Chaitanya Charitamrita. I don't remember. I may be not remembering. I have faulty memory, you can see today. So yes, worship of Nitha Gaura was prominent even in the time of Lord Chaitanya. I don't think it was before Lord Chaitanya's appearance, because his appearance, like I was saying before, was a secret, and it was revealed, like Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya didn't know that Lord Chaitanya was coming. Then Gopinathacharya had to explain to him, oh look, he's predicted in these different scriptures, but it was in a covered way to esoteric thing. But of course, the first deities in ISKCON were Jagannath deities. They also are very merciful deities. They don't accept as many offenses. And they appeared, and we know the story of how they appeared, Malati was in Cost Plus, and she saw these things. They were imported from India, these little strange figurines, and so she was thought, oh, let me show one to Prabhupada and see what he says. And she didn't have any idea that it was Krishna. She got the little black one and she brought it to Prabhupada, and it was small. She put it on the table, and Prabhupada paid his obeisances. And that's how deity worship then became. I mean, Prabhupada had spoken about deity worship in his lectures and things, but he hadn't actually installed any deities until Krishna actually came in that way. And so the first deities were the Jagannath deities. He had Shyamasundar Karva, large Jagannath, Baladev, and Subhadra here in San Francisco. Those same deities are still being worshipped in Berkeley Temple. I should announce, by the way, today is Ekadashi, of course. Today also Giriraj Maharaj is coming to Berkeley Temple to give a lecture this evening at 6 p.m. So if you want to go and see the deities that Shyamasundar carved in 1967 and get darshan of Lord Jagannath and Sri Sri Radha Gokulananda and Giriraj Maharaj, you can go to Berkeley this evening. Nitha Gaura, they don't accept offenses, and Srila Prabhupada established the worship of Nitai Gora in so many places. And when we usually when we started a new temple and the devotees were just being trained up and the pujaris weren't that expert, they wouldn't install Radha Krishna. Prabhupada wouldn't install Radha Krishna until they had some sufficient number of brahmanas who were dedicated and capable of performing the worship correctly, so as not to But getting back to your question about the holy name, the point is not that because they're so offensive we can go on, because they're so merciful that we can go on and offend them and they won't accept any offense. The point is we should feel that we don't want to. We have to learn not to commit any offenses. So by the mercy of Gaur Nitai, we can worship them, and even if we make some mistake, we'll be forgiven. But we have to be very careful not to make a mistake, and then we should also worship Radha and Krishna. But we should, and we should chant Hare Krishna. But we should do so, you know, learning to abandon all our offenses.
This is regarding the phone callers. If there are any callers on the phone, you can also ask questions by unmuting yourself by pressing *6, and then you can say whatever you like to say. And then in the end, please also mute yourself again.
Please just unmute yourself and say hello. Anyway, we want to know who's there on the phone. I don't hear any. I know it's probably just that, but I'll do it really quickly. I remember the argument about the brick, okay, the Zeno's paradox about the brick. What he said is, he took it for granted that everything can be divided and divided. If you accept space, if you accept the concept of space, the way our common sense experience of space, then if you have anything of any size, you can cut it in half. So if you have a brick, you could cut it in half, and you could cut that half in half, and you could cut that half in half, and any little particle of it, you could cut in half, infinitely, you know, forever. So he said, now, those little infinite particles, they either have some dimension or they have no dimension. If they have no dimension, then no matter how many of them you put stacked together, the brick will still have no dimension. And if they have some dimension, there being an infinite number of them, it would have to be enormously big. So therefore, it can't be. But I think that now the people using the concept of calculus, you can say that there's a rate that as you divide it smaller and smaller, there's also a rate of the size of the particles also being smaller. The number of the size of the particles and the size of the number of the particles and the size of the particles so that it retains the shape and you can divide by zero in that way using it. Okay. It's in the question was, where's the temple where Hridaya Chaitanya had the deities that look exactly like Lord Chaitanya and Lord Nityananda? And the deities are still there. Somehow they came out of his heart again to get or back on the altar. And it's in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, but I don't know where it is. I haven't been there. But it's somewhere in Bengal. It might be in Bangladesh, but it's somewhere in the Bengal area. And we can look it up. If you go to the Chaitanya Charitamrita, or if you have, does everybody have a Vedabase folio program? They're not very expensive anymore. When they first came out, we paid like $500 for them and everything. It's a nice service that the Bhaktivedanta Archives did. But if you go and you type in, like, or you could go to your Chaitanya Charitamrita and look in the index for Hridaya Chaitanya in every volume. But if you just go to Vedabase and you type in Hridaya Chaitanya or a couple of other words, you know, and deity or something like that, then you'll get, you know, maybe 12 hits. Or maybe 5 hits, and then you look at those hits, and you'll find the exact place where that is. So, shall we go on to Let's sing Udila Arana, and we should go on to Bhagavatam class.